Today is October 27th, 2025. I'm Bill Schneider. I'm here with Jim Fall and Karen Brewster, and we have the privilege of doing an interview today with Denny Kelso. So, Denny, thank you for taking the time to do this interview. And well, the way we usually start with this type of interview is to say, tell us a little bit about your life and bring us up to Alaska.
Well, I'm happy to do that, and there might even be some morsels in this that kind of reveal how my trajectory with subsistence division and subsistence policy, how it developed. I first came to Alaska. I grew up in the Midwest, and right after college, I came to Alaska and worked seasonally over the summer on a Title I special education program, which at that time was part of the Anchorage Borough School District's summer effort to help students, mostly elementary school students and a few middle school students, deal with the transition from village life to the big city of Anchorage. And it was a really wonderful learning experience for me as well as for them, because it gave us a chance in a camp setting. It was located at Birchwood Camp, outside of Anchorage, between Anchorage and Eagle River. And it was my introduction not only to Alaska, but also to what children from the villages brought with them. And it was a compelling mixture of things. During the subsequent years, I worked on Alaskan issues. And when I was in law school, I did a law school, I'm going to call it a thesis. It was a research paper that had to be of publishable quality, and it was a requirement for graduation. I did mine. I even took a semester off in order to do field research. I did mine on legal issues in federal protection for subsistence hunting and fishing on the lands protected or proposed for protection in the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, which had not yet been passed. As a result of that, I had a chance to, I was invited. I was just a complete rookie. I was invited to testify before Congress, before the subcommittee that was considering what was then called the D2 legislation that would become the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. And I did testify. That's a separate story. Happy to tell it, but it's longer than we need to. And the committee chair asked if I would submit a copy of that third year paper, that thesis, for publication in the committee record, which I did, and they did. So my work on legal issues in subsistence policy was widely circulated in Alaska, even before I returned, which I returned about a month later as a law clerk to Chief Justice Jay Rabinowitz in Fairbanks. And working with Justice Rabinowitz was a fabulous experience, but also a different story. And after clerking for the Alaska Supreme Court, I became a public defender based in Fairbanks, but most of my caseload was in the Inupiaq villages of the Arctic Slope. So I spent a lot of time in the villages, especially in Barrow, what was then Barrow. During that time, I was also kind of contacted and consulted a little bit about the issues in subsistence policy. And so after that, after I was had been a public defender, Tom Lahner reached out to me and said, "How'd you like to be the regional supervisor in Fairbanks?" One thing led to another, and I did, in fact, do that and had an office with the game division and Com Fish and Sport Fish in Fairbanks, at the at the regional offices. And one thing tailed after another. And when Tom Lahner left, that was my opportunity to move into a broader role with the subsistence division, and of course with ADF&G. So sorry about the long story, Bill, but that's my circuitous path that kind of wove its way in a sort of straight line to my engagement with the division and with a wonderful and very conscientious staff that I'd be happy to talk some more about.
Well, that's really a very critical part of the record. Thank you for sharing it. It gives us a perspective on all that you brought to that beginning there.
Thank you.
Could I test your memory a little bit, Denny, with dates? So when did let's go backwards. So when did you then start? When did Lahner contact you about beginning with the division?
Oh, well, I was moved into the director role when the section became a division in 81.
Yeah, that was
So,
February of 81, I know. Yeah.
yeah, so it would have probably been most of 1980, maybe a fragment of 79, just because when I talked quite frequently with Tom, not because I thought there was a job, but because I was interested in what this new section was seemed like a critical step to me. And he's a bright, funny, great character, and also somebody who doesn't suffer fools gladly. So I loved being able to talk with him about what the trajectory of the section was and where it was going. So I would guess it was about a year and a half before 1981. I could look it up, Jim, but I don't remember precisely. I was a public defender for just a couple of years after clerking for Justice Rabinowitz.
So what year did you come up to Alaska that first time?
The first time would have been probably 1970. Possibly 69 during the summer, but it would I believe it would be 70.
You were an undergraduate then?
I had just finished my
Oh.
undergraduate and before law school by a few years, and then after law school I did my work in Alaska in various roles in After the Public Defender Agency, I, of course, worked in ADF&G and DEC, but that's, we can talk more about that if it's useful. And then I went back to graduate school and completed a doctorate in energy and resources at UC Berkeley.
And so, who actually invited you to testify before Congress?
I was invited by the staff of the co-chair, who was Congressman John Seiberling, and was on a panel with some real luminaries. And there's a longer story that goes with that. But some of the Alaskans who were involved in that, in sort of the preparations for that, were people like Bob Weeden, who was at the University of Alaska, of course, as a biologist, and several other people who really were interested in both conservation and in the sustainability of the communities that relied on those wild lands and wild resources. Testimony put me on a panel with David Brower, with the president of the National Audubon Society, the president of the World with World Wildlife Fund, and I was just the rookie, a little dazzled by being up on a panel with these people. But it was, they knew where they were going. The committee chair was really excellent, the subcommittee chair. And it was my introduction to Don Young, as a matter of fact, who was on the committee by special appointment because of the subject, although he was not a regular member of the of Cyberlink's subcommittee.
And do you remember approximately what year that was?
Well, the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act was adopted in 1980.
That's correct.
So I would think it was 79.
But you weren't with the division yet.
No.
No.
I wasn't even clerking yet for Jay Rabinowitz, although I'd been hired. And I'm happy to talk more about this, but I don't need to. A considerable conflict developed between Congressman Young and me during my testimony. As a result of that, or the result of his annoyance with my testimony, the committee adjourned early for lunch, and I walked straight out to a pay telephone. Remember those? A pay telephone, and called Justice Rabinowitz to tell him that I'd had an encounter, and I just wanted to make sure he heard it from me rather than reading about it in the Daily News Minor. That whole episode is, sort of engraved in my memory because, I was just a kid in my last year of law school, and head on, nose to nose with the congressman for all Alaska, Don
And what
Young.
was the topic, Denny? Was it specifically subsistence, or was it a broader?
My portion of it was specifically subsistence.
And so, what did Young object to? I think this is relevant, don't.
Well, I can tell you, and Congressman Young didn't want to hear about this issue. I wasn't speaking more broadly to the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act bill, that was more appropriate for others, in that panel. But I was speaking to Title VIII, and I knew Title VIII very well, but I also had considerable familiarity with the rest of the bill. And so Congressman Young immediately went on the attack and said, "Have you ever been to Alaska?" Well, yes, I had, and I could tell him why and what I had done. And he wanted to know other things about that. And I acknowledged that I was on my way up to work for the Chief Justice of the Alaska Supreme Court. And then he started asking me very specific questions about the bill, not all of them having anything to do with subsistence. But I was able to answer quite clearly because I had just written a law school thesis on what Title VIII involved with respect to federal authority and constitutional authority, and so I was ready for that. And then he veered on to some questions about opportunities for sport hunting and fishing, and I knew I had some information, but it wasn't what I was there to talk about. So I tried to defer to others who would have that. And at one point, then, in a rather animated way, he asked and demanded to know how much area would still be open to sport hunting in Alaska if if this legislation passed. H.R. 39, I think it was. Excuse me. And I did not know that answer, although I could come fairly close. But unknown to me, someone that I knew a little bit was sitting immediately behind me in the audience, or in the gallery, and I was at the witness table. And as I was kind of thinking about trying to make sure I was responsive to Congressman Young, but not claiming expertise that I really didn't have, someone poked me on the elbow and slid a note to me about that big, and it had exactly what the acreage was. So I said, "Mr. Young, the acreage open to recreational hunting is," told him what the number was. He blew up, slammed the table, said, "This hearing is over," and stomped out and slammed the door, the side door to the committee room. Well, as a rookie, first timer, this was a little shocking, but it was also like, well, now what do I do? Other than I knew I was going to call Jay Rabinowitz and tell him what was going on. The committee then took a break, took a recess, early lunch break, and Congressman Seiberling came up to me and apologized for the disruption in the committee process. But it was one of those, and then it became, I was very comfortable with it because I had stuck with what I knew. It was my introduction to how things work in Congress, but also how Congressman Young approached his role, and I kept that. And later on, there were other encounters with the congressman, not long after that, but I felt it was a good experience, not fun, but a good experience. And then I felt pretty on pretty solid ground going forward in future interactions with him. Sorry about the long answer, Jim, but that's what happened.
No, this is absolutely fascinating. Were you going to ask a question, Bill, or because I was going to slightly shift the topic?
Oh, well, let me ask a question, and if it's out of order, we can hold it. Did you anticipate at that time that the provisions of Title VIII might create the type of conflict with the state constitution and this battle over urban-rural rights?
I did have some sense of that, Bill, but one of the things that I thought was an important learning from this overall experience, and I'm not trying to separate myself from it, I had some sense of that, partly from looking at what the special relationship between the federal government and the Alaska Native communities was in the context of the larger federal Aboriginal populations in this country. And I knew, of course, what the state constitution said, but I didn't know how the Alaska S Supreme Court would interpret that, nor did that come up while I was a law clerk. But yes, I had some sense of it. Here's where I would take that, though, if you'll forgive me, and don't hesitate to take me back to topic. I think those of us who were involved in subsistence policy, including advocates for rural communities, rural for mixed subsistence and cash, mixed subsistence and market economy, underestimated how intense that objection, that opposition would be, and how the strength of that opposition would be distributed. And for example, how it would crop up. And this, of course, we should talk about, and it's part of the materials that Karen sent to me. The extent to which that conflict played out inside the Alaska Department of Fish and Game was really significant. And I think some observers even prior to the state subsistence law being passed in 78 would have clearly understood that, but maybe not have understood how the vulnerabilities would play out, both legally and from a political standpoint. Is that responsive to your question?
Yeah, it's good.
So what I thought we could do, Denny, is shift over to the state scene, and because the state passed a subsistence law in 78, were you involved in the development of that?
I was not. I followed it because of my interest in my other work. My work on the federal issues, but I was not involved in the passage of that. Of course, advocates for subsistence interests, and I'm including primarily the Alaska Federation of Natives, advocates foresaw that, and the language for the 78 law in Alaska was very similar to what Title VIII adopted and at the federal level. So it wasn't as if there were two sharp forks in the road. It was really quite similar, and the issues were the same. But the constitutional provisions and this case law associated with them were very different. So they may have had similar language, but their implications would turn out to be rather different, as you well know.
But of course, one thing that the 78 law has had and is still in the law is the creation of a subsistence program
Yes.
within the state. Do you know much of the background on how that came about? Because it became what you did.
Yes. I don't have insight into how the politics was arrayed there. I know that and again, this is from what others have told me, I was not involved in developing the language at all, but what I understand from advocates at the time was that they believed that the role of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game would continue to be crucial, that the boards of fisheries and game had rulemaking authority within the scope of what they were authorized to do, but that was critical to the future of subsistence use of renewable resources in Alaska, so that unless you had some entity within the Alaska Department of Fish and Game to provide input, reliable, respectable, straight ahead science, or whether it's biological science or social science, that there wasn't much chance of the rulemaking by the boards of fisheries and game reflecting what reality was in rural Alaska. And so they saw that as a critical thing. They may have thought that there would be more of a driver there than there was. I mean, I think the idea that if you just tell the truth and be specific, that change, that policy will follow. I think that isn't necessarily the case. And I think that was a widely shared hope that, and of course, Tom Lahner has written about that and spoken about that at some length. And even at the time that Lahner was head of the subsistence section, I think there was still quite a sense that the way the system was structured could be adapted if the inputs were more understood and were more extensive than what they had been in the past. So it's a crucial question, I think. And that's one of the things that I think we, even if we had foreseen the challenges, I'm not sure the tools, the levers were there to address them. I do think, however, and we can come back to this if you like, I do think that the work that subsistence division staff did, and the work that some, for goodness sakes, that some others in the department also did. I don't want to leave out, it's not as if everybody in game division or everybody in sport fish or comp fish was an opponent. That's not the case. But I think the best colleagues we had in those other divisions were really interested, genuinely interested in what you and others in subsistence division were learning. And they brought their own contributions. I mean, understanding the dynamics of the porcupine caribou herd, or of the Western Arctic herd, or of salmon fisheries and the changes that were underway. I mean, those are things that cut across disciplinary lines. But there was also very strong opposition in some of those divisions, as all three of you recognize. And that was crucial to shaping how we did our work and how we made the bridge or the combination of strengths in ethnography combined with quantitative assessments and mapping of use patterns. And that all ties in with why would people in the villages trust us with that information? And how did we proceed so that they could? And how did we prove that we were trustable? And also trustable to fish biologists, or trustable that our data were straight ahead and not somehow skewed when we went to decision makers, whether at the state or federal level.
So, how did you develop that trust?
There actually were some specific ways we went about that. I'm not suggesting that I was the one who thought about how to do it, but I certainly was a participant with our colleagues. And here's how I would characterize it. First of all, we had to be listeners. We had to really be listeners. And that is a skill set. Look who I'm talking to here, Karen. To talk to you about listening is like, inventing gravity or something. But we had to prove that. And the way you do that is by coming in with humility and questions and really listening, and then being able to demonstrate that you not only listened, but you heard what people were saying. People in many villages, maybe most, lived in a socioeconomic system that often was at odds with what the regulations actually allowed. And that was not because they wanted to be violators. It's because the regulations didn't reflect reality. And having a voice to say what reality was, that was crucial. But it was also risky to the people who provided the information. So it didn't take long before there was the opportunity to demonstrate that we would protect things that were had off been offered to us in confidence, and the things that were not offered in confidence that we would represent truly and fairly. And people like, and I'm going to acknowledge right now, Jim Fall is one of the people who led the way on that. Jim put up with a lot of, I think, abusive treatment in front of the Board of Game and Board of Fisheries, because he came with a scholar's sensibility, but a listener's commitment to representing people fairly. And that was true of others as well. In the team. And I mentioned Jim only because he's on this call with us. But I could give you a longer list, and you know many of them because they're still in Alaska, still doing various kinds of work. And so I think what we did was to go out with real questions that mattered to the people whose livelihoods and whose communities depended on it. We really listened. If we had to change how we asked the question or change how we recorded our understanding, then we could do that. We would do that. We weren't, our job was not to shape their content. It was to represent accurately their input and to have that interpret that in the context of the decision framework that where it was going to be used. And I remember quite clearly, if you might wouldn't mind my giving you a field example, I was in the field, I think with Elizabeth Andrews, and we went to an elder's home that was normal, and she knew him some, maybe well enough to do this. He didn't know me at all, but he trusted her, and we sat down on the floor, and he drew on a map the areas that he used, and including really sensitive information that, like trap lines and seasonal camps and things that really mattered in his life and that he was willing to share because he trusted her, and he figured that if she was going to have me along, that he'd take the chance. That's what we did, and that's how. And then we were scrupulously careful to represent it accurately, to put it in the larger context that many of most of our sources did not have, because that they we weren't expecting them to have the larger context. We wanted them to talk about what their life, what they did in the course of their of pursuing their lives and their community life, and who depended on what and when, and that's our job, is to help it fit into a larger context that made sense for the rules that they faced and that everybody, you know, had to embrace if this was going to work for wildlife and fisheries management. The other thing I would say is, and this one is one where Jim Fall really took a lead, and so did some others, but Jim was on the front line of this all the time, and that was to hold your ground in the Board of Fisheries or the Board of Game, and not to let them switch it and shift the input so that it met other needs, but to really hold the line in terms of what information we were supplying and why it was reliable. And I'll say right now, Jim Fall took a lot of abuse because he wouldn't yield on that. But that mattered because people in the audience who had the ear of statewide organizations like AFN paid attention. Could Jim Fall be derailed from his analysis? No. And that mattered. Then there was a feedback loop that, yeah, these people are okay to talk to, and they're trustable. And here's the evidence of that. Karen, does that respond?
Yeah, I think so. And I don't know about if you have any personal experience you want to talk about with the boards, as you mentioned with Jim.
Yes, in a couple of ways. One of them was that I would be there at the table, whether it was Jim or Susan Georgette or Jim Magdans, or Bob Wolf or Linda Alanna. The list of team members, you know, if they were providing information, I'd be at the table with them. From time to time, I would have a chance to intervene if I thought they were being abused, or if their information was being twisted. And for goodness sakes, not every board encounter involved that, and not every board member would try to do that, but sometimes it happened, and that was an opportunity for me to step in, and that would also build some confidence with my team that I was with them, and I trusted their insights and their their honesty in laying it out. So from time to time, I'd have a chance to do that. And from time to time, I would have a chance to say to the board or to a board member, that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about what we have gathered in the field and how that analysis fits in with the larger picture. We're not here to advocate for one group or another. We are here to provide the information that's crucial to making good decisions that affect communities and that affect the future of wild resources that you manage. Go ahead, sorry.
A couple of things. One, I have to admit that when I was at board meetings and things were getting a little uncomfortable, when Denny walked into the room, I breathed a sigh of relief. Oh, good. here's somebody that's going to bail me out of where I am. I had a couple of things, but is following up on that. There's three things I wanted to do. Well, a lot of things, but one is I'm a little curious about what the role of regional supervisor was when you first started with the division, what your assignments were, what the expectations were, what the issues were that you were handed. Let's do that.
That's Jim, that's an insightful question. And the truth is, I kind of invented it as I went along. Tom said, you can be the research and policy director, essentially statewide. But he brought Linda Ilana in, and she clearly had the right background and interests to deal with the research elements. You were not far behind. Bob Wolf was not far behind in terms of the timeline for coming on board. And we had a terrific team, and I'm probably leaving people out. I don't mean to. A terrific team to craft that research agenda. But I still had the portfolio to do the kind of policy research. And frankly, when I became director rather than the regional supervisor, and I'm not trying to miss your question about what the regional supervisor does. I was immediately in a situation where some members of the Department of Fish and Game, as Karen's materials point out, were quite hostile to the subsistence division. They viewed subsistence as simply a user group that had advocates that had now been planted in the department over their objections. It was not a good place to be. And that started while I was the regional supervisor in Fairbanks. And so every day when I walked in, I kind of paid attention to, oh, who was there? Because it was often very uncomfortable. And again, not everybody. That would not be fair and it wouldn't be accurate. I also had people from other divisions who were really interested in what we were doing, but also sometimes just wanted to talk about how the policy actually worked. So part of what I did as a regional supervisor, you thought I'd lost the train of thought, didn't you, Jim? But no, or maybe. What I did was basically staff as an kind of an outpost in Fairbanks. A part of the division that otherwise wouldn't be, I mean, part of the department that otherwise wouldn't be gathering information. And here's where I thought I could be particularly useful. For one thing, I actually did understand the legal issues, including both strengths and weaknesses and ambiguities. And so that I was on solid footing. But the other thing is, I knew I had the secret code, and the secret code was this: if you're going to manage wildlife and fisheries, you're really managing human behavior. And if you're going to manage human behavior, you need to have real data, not just the data that you think is comfortable or the data that you're most familiar with. And the piece that subsistence division could provide was ethnographic, it was spatial, and at fairly early, and Jim, you could help me nail down when we really tried to do this without sacrificing the ethnographic component. The numbers, having quantitative information was what the Board of Fisheries and the Board of Game are most comfortable dealing with. And at some point, some of our colleagues in the other divisions realized that they actually didn't have reliable information. And so it was kind of a fiction that they could manage the uses for which they had no real consistent data. And that's something that the subsistence division resource specialists could provide. And that's also why it was so crucial that we had staff from the communities. They provided credibility, they provided direct check on how what quality of information we were getting. They themselves had deep personal expertise, and that was one of the things we did really well, is have in the villages, I don't remember what their proper titles were now, technicians, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
But that was crucial. That was a really valuable thing, and we knew to do that pretty much from the beginning because we needed those teams. So as a regional supervisor, I'd already done a fair amount of work in villages when I was a public defender. Now I was not seeing the people that I was working with were not in most instances were not the leaders of the communities because they were defendants in criminal cases. But when I started as a public defender, my on sort of on scene mentor in Barrow was Sadie Nailcock, who had been the magistrate not only when I started, but also for the duck-in that three of you will know about, of course, and perhaps remember. Bill, you would probably remember that, and maybe Karen, but it may have predated you a bit. So the long and short of it is there was quite a bit that I could convey to my colleagues at the regional level that began to lay the groundwork for them to see that this actually was quite valuable information that they to which for which they could have no access otherwise. And so that not everybody saw that it was useful, but many of them began to see that this was data that they needed in order for it to be an effective management system. Now, I'm leaving out the cautions that Tom Lawner has provided about co-optation and loss of agency. I'm leaving that aside. It's really pretty well developed in the excerpts, Karen, that you provided to me. But that way of improving management through listening to people who otherwise would be just invisible was, I think, one of the major contributions I could make in Fairbanks. And Jim, that's true for the for our the regional supervisor can do a certain amount, but that's dealing with other people in those offices. The people like you and other resource specialists around the state, they're the ones that actually made that real by working with people, developing trust, recording data, being out in the field with them, and having a partner in the local communities that was respected by others and whose credibility we could associate with.
So you earlier when you were describing when you started in Fairbanks working for the division, you said that there was a certain amount of hostility to the program. Why do you think that was? Where did that come from?
Some of it had to do with the autonomy that the management divisions were used to. The idea that we're the experts, we know how to do this, we don't need a pack of social scientists telling us what to do. And of course, the subsistence division was not actually a pack of social scientists. There were a whole variety of skill sets, academic backgrounds, and abilities to work in the field. But there was just, like, we don't need these people, bunch of pointy-headed social scientists. Let's just do what we're going to do. We'll ignore it. Well, then they couldn't ignore it because there was actually legislation. And the advocates for subsistence reliant communities were not afraid to go to court. So suddenly they couldn't just ignore it, nor did they have the data to point in some other direction because they couldn't reach it because they weren't trusted. Now, am I including everybody as being not trusted? No. I mean, John Burns on Walrus, of course, he had worked years to establish that relationship to be out on the ice with hunters. And I could give other examples too, which is why it was not just a kind of a one size fits all. Not everybody in each of those other divisions was hostile, but it was not comfortable to be in the office in Fairbanks when I knew perfectly well that some of those other 35 signatories to get rid of the subsistence law and to get rid of the subsistence division, which was part of the law of the initiative, were right there. And when one of the other division directors took time off to campaign for the repeal, for the subsistence repealer, and when the spouse of one of the other regional supervisors gave it a lot of personal time in trying to accomplish the repeal, that that was uncomfortable. And sometimes it would break out in some pretty nasty exchanges, derogatory statements. Then they've sometimes felt empowered just to do that because their boss was doing it. And so why the hell not? But it was a more textured picture than just that. Nevertheless, it was not fun to go into the office and know that I had to just look over my shoulder. I will say this, though, can I take one quick tangent?
Sure.
One of my most important challenges in as the director, and frankly, one of the most rewarding things that happened to me in working with the division is, and you'll remember this, so you can be a reality check on whether I tell it right. Some of the resource specialist team really wanted to be able to weigh in on this initiative. And I said, no. I said, our job here and our strength is not to take the bait, not to weigh in as partisans. Even though we are part of the target, we need to establish and maintain our credibility as straight ahead, scientifically grounded tellers of the truth of what was reality and come in with good data every time, good data and analysis, but not to do what some others in the department are doing, which undercuts their credibility, and we don't need to go there. We must not go there, or we're then it's just a matter of who has more power in the in influencing constituencies. Now, here's what I'm where I'm going with that. Whether I was correct or not, and I still think I was correct, the fact is the team accepted that. And I felt backed up. I felt as if the team knew that I really had the backs of the staff and that I knew enough and had enough experience to be able to give a straight ahead advice, but also that they would trust me with that. And that was, from my perspective, was huge. That trust was so valuable to me, but it also was so valuable to the development of the division going forward. Now it helped that the Citizens Initiative failed, the repealer failed, but the fact is that honest exchange among staff of the subsistence division was pivotal, and it was pivotal to me. I still think of it as a high point in my experience in working with other professionals in these roles, but certainly a high point in my time at the Department of Fish and Game.
And just to add some context here for people who are listening to this and don't know the full background on it, there was an effort to repeal the state law through an initiative process in 1982. And what that meant is that the people of the state would vote in the November 82 election as to whether to simply repeal the state law, which included the subsistence preference, the definitions, and the creation of the subsistence section that then became the division. And there were those in the department who advocated for themselves as professionals to support that initiative. And they wrote a memo with that what we call the 35 signatory memo, because allegedly 35 department employees signed that memo that basically laid out the case for repeal of the law. And one of the points that they made was directed at the Division of Subsistence, alleging that it was simply a advocacy group that wasn't supportive of fish and wildlife conservation and really needed to go away. So it certainly is understandable as to why some staff within the division were wanting to respond to that. And of course, we did respond, but in a very measured way. And Denny, you did draft and then send a rebuttal to every point that was in that memo. But just as that background, and for those who don't know, the initiative, of course, did fail by a wide margin in November of 82, and the program moved forward. But that's just a little context for that. I wanted to back up a little bit though, because we had some email exchanges on this. One of the first what's the word presentations that the division and it was I think still a section at that point did before the board had to do with the case in Tyonek. Tyonek is a Alaska Native community on Cook Inlet that traditionally depended upon king salmon for subsistence purposes, but because of the depletions in that in those stocks, the subsistence fishery as well as sport and commercial fisheries had been closed for many years, and when the stocks recovered. The Board of Fisheries did adopt sport fishing regulations, but not subsistence regulations. And this is in 1979, after the subsistence law was adopted in 78. And Tyonek came to the board asking for a subsistence fishery also. And maybe we could talk a little bit about that. But do you have do you recall much about that process? Were you involved in it?
I'd recall some in that process, and but incompletely, Jim, because it had begun before I was at the section division. However, that's an issue that was around for a long time, and so it was already rolling by the time I got there. But I'm not trying to deflect it. We were really closely engaged. And Jim, you may have done some of this work directly, some of this analysis yourself. Ron Stanek certainly had done a lot of work in Tionic.
And
I learned,
Alice Stickney
and
was.
Alice Stickney, of course, of course, of course. And I remember how much I learned about the use of king salmon. By the community, and why it was so important in the spring when the kings first showed up, and how it was used, and why it was a pivotal resource, and why they would go to the mat to make sure that it both to protect the salmon stocks, but also to use them if they could be harvested. And so that was, I'll tell you how it, what it symbolized was the board simply saying no in the face of what the law required and not listening to the community, and really not valuing that socioeconomic data. And in that instance, people came in to testify. It wasn't just us members of the subsistence division, like Alice and Ron. I mean, it really was a head-on, we hear you, we're not listening. And that's the way it was perceived in Tionic. But also more broadly, and that's where I think the a lot of the orientation toward the need for litigation developed. That was a perfect early example of where, at least for the people of Tionic, it looked as if the board had just ignored what the law required. And they came in with data, and they came in person to stand up for the harvest. But I was not directly involved in it. And of course, the litigation had stood on its own footing. And other than whether any of our technical reports were submitted as evidence, I don't know. But I was not involved in that part at all. But I did hear some of the proceedings before the board. But was not involved in presentations other than the work that Stickney and Stanek had done.
So, before we started this conversation, you had asked for some of the background as a reminder, and there was a technical paper eventually published, and it's basically the report that the division or the section then did for the board. And what I was reminded of is that the Tionic came to the Board of Fisheries, and I think it was a regularly scheduled meeting in December of 1979, and the board asked for more information. I'm pretty sure there was testimony from several elders from Tionic at that meeting. Then the section, and I think it was mostly Alice, but also Paul Cunningham might have played a role, went to Tionic and did interviews with people there about their uses of king salmon. And that was in February of 1980. And then the board took up the proposals in March of 1980 and basically said no. So were you at either of those meetings, Denny? Do you remember?
A clarification on your question. You said the board said no,
Yeah.
meaning they didn't support the subsistence provision.
They turned down the proposals in March of 1980 and said we're not going to adopt your proposal to have a subsistence king salmon fishery. Yeah.
And that was the end of it.
No, oh no, my goodness, no.
That's when the village filed their lawsuit.
Yeah.
That's correct. My
I see
question was
the
whether you
difference.
were at
Yeah.
either of those meetings.
You know, I think I don't know whether I had been appointed in the section yet, but I think that if I weren't, at least Tom Lawner invited me to just come and watch. But I think when the supplemental report was provided, I think I was probably newly on board, because I kind of remember that's one of the examples where I was taken aback by how little some board members, not all of them, but some board members cared to pay attention to the socioeconomic data. And you're probably right, Paul Cunningham, who was kind of the deputy, I think you may have been deputy chief of the
That's right.
section,
That's
but
right.
he was a, I'm going to call him a biometrician, but he had advanced analytic skills, and I think he was probably involved directly in the analysis, not necessarily the presentation, but he may well have been as well on that. But yes, I just the development of it, the history of it, I had missed part of it, but I had been paying attention to it, so I can't remember exactly where I might have been at the time that it went to the board for that final consideration.
Yeah, and then of course, Tyonek filed suit, and Norm Cohen and
Yep.
Don Mitchell were their attorneys. And we did talk to Larry Spengler a bit about this. And she also was not at that that March meeting. And what she said is that, as far as she knows, the Board of Fisheries had never really been briefed on what the subsistence law required. And when Norm and Don submitted their whatever it's called, motion for summary judgment and background, it sounds like the state basically threw in the towel, that Larry and John Gisberg went over the record and just said, "Don, Norm, you're absolutely right." And the fishery then happened that very May of 1980, and then eventually the board went back and adopted regulations in support of the subsistence fishery. But that said, afterwards, and this led up to the repeal initiative in 82, the Tyonek case was often cited as an example of management by the courts. And
Yeah.
and also, I have yet to talk to anybody recently. Ron was not at that meeting in March. Larry was not. But I do remember when I first started working for the division, Alice Stickney did describe her experience at that board meeting, and it was not fun.
No.
Do you remember that at all?
I just remember that it was essentially disregarded. And
Yeah.
frankly, again, I want to be careful not to say that all board members were handled it this way, but they were not respectful. Some were just not respectful, which is kind of shocking for a young professional really trying to do a responsible job coming to a state regulatory decision-making agency and be treated that way.
Yeah. So after the repeal initiative failed, did you see a change in two areas? One, attitudes within the department, and secondly, within the program. Did the program start to change in any way?
I'm going to take them in that order. That the timing of it, of the initiative, coincided with the statewide politics. And so part of what was going on was that the commissioner's role and the directors of the divisions were affected by the way the gubernatorial politics were shaping up. And so, Commissioner Skoog was very concerned about what his role might be in the future. He made a change at the game division. I mean, there was a lot of dynamic in play that I didn't have access to, didn't need access to, but that changed the way the department overall approached things. Now, the game biologists and fish biologists are not, they're not political appointees, so their jobs were not affected, but certainly they got the message about what was acceptable and what wasn't. And so that, I think there was a reorientation. But the other thing that happened was the fact that the subsistence division wasn't going away. So you had to deal with them. And the fact is, you and others were bringing in really high quality data and analysis to go with it on multiple levels. So it itself was beginning to make inroads. And the governor gets a chance to make appointments to the Board of Fisheries and the Board of Game, and there was evolution there over time as well. When this all started, Governor Jay Hammond, who had, strong Bristol Bay roots, was quite supportive in not he opposed. Both individually and as a matter of his administration, opposed this repealer initiative. But after his term ended, there was not much appetite for further pushing that issue. There certainly were strong feelings in the department, I'm sure, but there wasn't a basis to try to make to push it forward because it was gone. In the division of subsistence, I think our message was, let's not be arrogant. These feelings, these attitudes, I guess it's the same in some ways. These attitudes slash feelings are still going to be there, but let's overcome it with the quality of our work. And I think we did that, but we did it with the assurance that we were able to continue and that our information had a place at the table. And that was a big deal. At least it was a big deal to me because then you couldn't just bank on others in the department who didn't like our work, couldn't just bank on being able to get the Board of Game or Board of Fisheries to ignore it. Now it was part of the playing field. And I've got more than one metaphor going there, Jim, but it was now it was they had to deal with it. And so what mattered from my perspective, and I think was pretty well shared in the division, was we need to redouble our efforts to have high quality data that's responsive to the specific issues that they have to decide. That contributed to our being more quantitative. I hope it didn't cause us to ignore other ethnographic qualitative data. But it certainly meant that we tried to tailor our look down the path and tailor our work so that it was relevant to issues that we knew were going to come up, whether it was Nelchina caribou or porcupine caribou or Western Arctic herd or what was happening in fisheries in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. I mean, I'm just throwing those out without regard to what order any of that came in. But we knew that these were going to be issues, and we we tried to tailor our work so that it was responsive, but also that it embraced the best skill sets that we had on both the quantitative and the qualitative sides. Do you think that's on track? Do you think that's how would that is that how you read it?
Yes, and I do know that the first year that I worked for the division, I heard this, actually voiced by some department employees that we were short term, that they were going to disappear, so don't really worry about them. They won't be here for long, and we'll just go back to being biologists and managing the resources and not worrying about these guys that are, just advocates for native people.
Right.
And I think that, once we were here to stay, even people who weren't particularly supportive before, basically became more supportive. You could at least talk with them about what was needed and what we were learning. And some of them even became interested.
Yeah.
I think we've touched on this in a broad way, but I'll ask it in case there's some other things to pick up on. Looking back now, how would you characterize the legacy of the subsistence division?
That is both a fair and complex question, Bill. But you knew that. That's why you asked it. Let me give you let me start, and then I'd love to have you your guidance and make sure that I'm responding to it. I think part of the legacy is what we were just talking about, how these data sets gathered by the Division of Subsistence, and let's face it, we're the interpreters. The people who provide those data are the people who live in the communities with these complex seasonal networks of use and exchange. And so credit where credit is due. They trusted it with trusted us with it. I think we respected that trust and earned its continuation. So having that be part of the database for the management of wild resources, I think was a major contribution. Is it a complete story? No, that's a continuing story, just in the way that life in rural Alaska is a continuing evolution. But that was a crucial element. I think it was crucial that there were people in, I do think it's some of what the advocates before there was a subsistence section or division, what they thought about the importance of having some voices inside the department to talk about what reality was in the villages. That actually was quite, it may have been played out in a different way than the advocates envisioned, but it was really quite important. Because then you had a record, not just a letter or a report going into to the board that they might or might not contribute, I mean, consider, but a record. It's part of the legal basis for evaluating the correctness of their decisions. So that had some genuine value as well. I believe that one of the other things that was quite significant, but undervalued, not by people on this in this conversation, but undervalued, is that expertise in the communities that are reliant on the mixture of uses in which subsistence is an important part, that expertise was actually acknowledged. It had to be acknowledged. And that was pretty valuable, including the eventual director of the division being from rural Alaska.
Mary Pete, we're talking about.
Mary Pete, for sure. And if, you know, Mary Pete came equipped with great credentials for the job. But the point is, she could have done a lot of different things, and she chose to do that. And I had great respect and appreciation for her, and her premature loss by her passing was a real loss to this trajectory.
And the state.
To the state leadership at a variety of levels. It's really was a real loss. But the fact is that an Alaska Native person could be the director and did be the director. And people from the villages were crucial to making this work and to participate effectively in the management of wild renewable resources in the state. That was a true legacy item that would not necessarily have happened without the division being in place, because there wouldn't have been a vehicle for that. I think also there are things that are continuing to evolve now that were kind of, I don't know, pre the staff was kind of prescient, the subsistence division staff, in seeing things developing. And I'm thinking about climate disruption and the changes in patterns of resource availability, what's happening with walrus, with caribou movements, with populations of caribou. We were engaged in the development of an administrative agreement between the US and Canada for the management of the porcupine caribou herd. Now that wasn't, that was during a federal administration that did not want it to address habitat. That was off the table. But the fact is we had a role in really shaping that agreement and making it happen. That was when Jonathan Solomon was the leader of 3Gs in the upper Yukon, porcupine drainages. Anyway, long and short of it is, I think that this became the role of the division, and the skill sets represented by the staff of the division became a respectable part of the overall policy framework. Is it a driver? Well, is any single set of actors a driver for state and federal policy? Of course not, but that's too much to expect. What we really want is for there to be an honest process that really considers the relevant data, and is honest about how it uses those data. So when I read some of Tom Lahner's stuff, and I have great respect for and affection for Tom Lahner, in some ways he is a clear voice and a particular viewpoint that has not carried the day on these issues. And I'm sorry, I know that Jim, you might have to clarify further, or Karen or Bill, about Lahner's positions. And Karen, you've supplied some really valuable quotes that I read carefully before this discussion. The fact is, this is my bias, we have to work within the available framework. And the people who are affected by the decisions that that policy framework makes need to have a role at the table. And although Dr. Lahner's perspective is different on how that works and whether it can be co-opted and whether it's, caused a valuable thing, I think that overall the multiple legacy elements have been significant, really significant, and that they will carry forward. And I think the skill sets are now here to stay in terms of how state and federal policy deal with wild renewable resources. Bill, is that even close to responding?
Yeah, it is. And the reason I asked the question is, I've been concerned from a historical standpoint about the lack of understanding of Alaska Natives throughout the historic period I mean, it wasn't until the 1940s that there was any basic research dealing with Alaska Native communities and how they lived and what their lives were like in any formal way. And then I got thinking, well, look at the subsistence division and the volumes of studies that they've put together over the years. You know, a massive record. And so that was the reason I asked the question about the legacy, thinking in terms of that basic information.
I like your answer better than mine
No.
because that body of work it really matters. It matters as a record, it matters as insight into how human systems work and how they evolve. One of the notes, Jim had sent me a message, and one of the things he invited me to do is to identify things that we had achieved, which you just asked about, but also missed opportunities or things that were shortcomings. And one of the things that I made on my yellow pad, made a note that's really important to me is we were voices for, and Bill, you are a voice for this as well, to see human systems as dynamic. And as you point out, it was very late that Alaska Native peoples and communities were really engaged and understood as having systems that were successful communities, successful regions, adaptive, smart, skillful. I mean, it's amazing that it was the 40s before some of that. But the danger is twofold, at least. The two that I can think of is you would never do this, and none of the three of you would do this. There's a tendency to think of it as kind of frozen in time. And maybe not frozen in 1948, but that Alaska Native communities are just what we say they are at the time we are thinking of, whether it's, you know, in the 1960s or the 1970s or whenever it might be. There's no such thing as a fixed human community. There's an adaptive, dynamic, changeable, vulnerable, successful, whatever the mix is. And that, I think, our subsistence division data set really speaks to. The other piece of that, though, that I would say, and not though, and that I would emphasize is that most Alaska rural communities are not only Native communities. They're maybe predominantly Native communities, but they're mixed. There are people whose families are Native and non-Native. There's leadership, maybe Native and non-Native. They may have come from a long line of people who are mixed in their racial heritage. And so, if I were doing it again, I would make sure that whenever an issue was coming up for a decision by the Board of Fisheries or the Board of Game, that you had a team of people. You'd have the data gathered and analyzed by the subsistence division as a clearly presented element. And the proponents of the policy change or the regulatory change that is before the board would not be only an Alaska Native person or only a non-Native person, but a team, a couple of people or three people who represent the scope of that of those communities in terms of their interests, of their economic status, of their racial makeup, so that it was less easy to put it in a category, which sometimes the boards did. This is an Alaska Native issue. Do we pay attention to an Alaska Native issue? Well, That's not quite accurate. Alaska Native people have a real stake in this, but their communities are more complex than that. And I would make sure that we always had that mixture represented, so it was not so easy to just categorize it.
Yeah, I think that's a good point.
Well, you mentioned the mixed rural, native, non-native. How did that all play out on the policy side when you were working with the division? How you addressed that?
There was a tendency to think of, okay, Karen, I want to address that straight ahead, but the caution that I was kind of leaning on is many times I heard in the process of board meetings, but also in agency, whether it was Fish and Game or other state agencies, talking about the Alaska Native community, the Alaska Native interests. And I think that oversimplifies it, but it also makes it into a caricature. So, what I liked about the Division of Subsistence, one of the things I really liked is the mixture. There were men and women, urban and non-urban, native and non-native parts of our, 40 or so, 47, whatever it is, number of staffers. And that provided a different kind of insight, and it made it harder to just characterize it one way or the other. From the standpoint of policy, I think it made it both more realistic to have policy that affected the transition between urban and rural, which in Alaska is sometimes confusing. So the Nelchina Caribou Herd would be an example of that kind of mixture of uses and interests. The Yukon fisheries would be an example, although it was more, in the river system and then offshore. But where you have, it isn't just Alaska Native interests, it's a mixture of things and mixture of peoples, and having the different perspectives, but also just acknowledging the mixture of economic roles. The idea that subsistence use is not a standalone, and that it isn't divorced from financial capacity to have the tools to do subsistence use. There's even under the best of circumstances, these are difficult things to evaluate. But if you don't recognize the mixture, the complexity, the dynamic interchange, the temporal spread, the year-to-year changes, then you don't actually get the right answer. You get something else. And I think part of what the division, and frankly, the contributions that the three of you have made, really emphasizes the importance of seeing the full texture and not just labeling it in a way that makes your decision easier but doesn't make it better.
Following up on that, and we'll have to decide how much more we want to talk, or but this is it follows directly from what we were just talking about, is that one of the challenges that the division's program faced in the early 80s was helping the state and the boards to comply with the requirements of Title
Yep.
VIII. And there were several joint board meetings where regulations were adopted that were consistent with the requirements of Title VIII. We could talk a little bit about that, but another aspect of it that the division was really involved in And much of this might have happened, Denny, after you actually moved on to be deputy commissioner, was addressing the idea of a mixed subsistence cash economy and how it funneled into defining rural places and non-rural places, and then eventually became subsistence and non-subsistence areas.
Right.
I don't know whether you had any comments on that process. You might have been more of an observer for some of that, but I do remember you at more than one joint board meeting talking about the requirements of Title VIII and how to go about retaining state management.
Jim, I think that's a really important observation. And although this predated my being involved in policy discussions, I think the proponents of Title VIII and of the provision that required the state to be in compliance with Title VIII in order to retain management on all lands probably overestimated how much of a driver that would be. That is, that the state would care so much about not losing management authority over lands that were federal lands. Now, in fairness, I got to say, the number of tools available were limited, or the kinds of tools. So maybe that was the only tool that looked as if it had any leverage. But I think it was kind of a surprise that the state was willing to let it go on federal lands.
Eventually, yeah.
Yeah, eventually, right. So the Title VIII was pretty much, there may have been some language tweaks, but Title VIII was pretty well baked by the time I started doing research and analysis on federal authorities. And of course, the reason is because it was so closely tracking what the language was in the state law. And the idea was, it's so close that the state doesn't have to do something whole brand new. They just have to make sure that they carry out the congressional intention in what Title VIII turned out to be. And that kind of spiraled out of, completely out of what I think was envisioned originally, although that was not something that I had any, I was not part of that strategy. I'm not trying to disavow it. I'm just saying I think it was kind of surprising that the state eventually was able to let go of that. And then a hybrid system developed, and the hybrid system benefited from the work that the Subsistence Division had already done, frankly. Look at how the federal advisory groups were developed. And anyway, that's a longer discussion, I realize. But it's not as if the division's work was only usable by state agencies. The federal agencies benefited from it right away and probably had a little springboard because of what you had done. I'm sorry, I disappeared. I'm coming back. If I'm able to.
Yeah, you're still there.
Am I still visible?
Yes.
Yep.
Well, there are some disadvantages to the three of you. Sorry.
Perfect.
I'm not going to mess with this for fear that I'll cut myself off.
Well, sort of along those lines is yeah, how you dealt with all these legal and policy changes.
Partly I have to tell you just a little joke on myself. I was perfectly happy continuing as the in the Division of Subsistence, and I had not planned any departure. But when the new governor came in, when Governor Sheffield came in, I just assumed that he would appoint his own team overall. And I was packing up my office. When I was literally packing up my office, when I got the call saying, "Would you be interested in being the deputy commissioner?" Well, I wasn't sure whether I would be interested in being the deputy commissioner, but my colleague said this is really important to maintain and to be a kind of a watchdog was not the word they would have used, but to make sure that the progress made in the subsistence division and other divisions is not lost. And being the deputy commissioner is a better place to do that because the commissioner is always in the, political crosshairs, whereas the deputy is more able to do actual conservation and management work. So I said yes to that. I knew that we had really good people in a position to step into the director role, and of course Steve Behnke was in that trajectory. And then when we had another gubernatorial transition, I was packing up my office because when Steve Cooper came in, obviously he was going to put his own team in, and I was literally had the boxes ready to go when I got a call from the chief of staff saying, "Would you be interested in being commissioner of environmental conservation?" I thought, "Well, how many times will I get this phone call?" One, and so I said yes to that. But here's where I'm going. I wasn't necessarily involved in the transitions then that would be after I was Deputy Commissioner of Fish and Game that were made with respect to subsistence policy and fish and game management, fish and wildlife management. But the work of the division was so relevant to what happened in my work in environmental conservation, ranging from things that had to do with drinking water safety in villages, which, does anybody think about that? Well, we should. And the answer is yes, but that doesn't mean that we have an easy fix. But we did engage that quite often, pretty much continuously, but we didn't always have resources to solve it, but we did some. And so, for example, if you had a village that had small fish and other organisms coming out of the taps, you probably needed to do something that wouldn't be safe. And that's a real example. The long and short of it is the work at DEC continued to use the work that had been done in the Division of Subsistence and was still being done. And then as the questions that you asked me to think about arose after the Exxon, during the Exxon Valdez oil spill, the work that the Subsistence Division staff had done in Prince William Sound was absolutely crucial. Absolutely crucial. And it didn't require a year and a half of lead time. It was there. Boom. And we could look at what Chinigo Bay, what the situation was in Chinigo Bay and in other communities that were affected. And we would remember this, but most people don't, that spill affected shoreline and marine nearshore waters on an area in length equal to the length of the coast of California. So this was like there was no way you could gather a bunch of information fast enough to factor in, but the Division of Subsistence already had the framework and already had the relationships in Prince William Sound that really could help put legs on not only how to think about the documentation of damage, but also what restoration might look like and who needed to be involved and how the communities needed to be involved and how the regional and village corporations needed to play in the At any rate, you hear where I'm going, and now I've taken up way too much time going there. But I was made me quite proud of the work that had been already done by the Division of Subsistence, and we put legs on it right away. It just was crucial. And I think the the division should still be proud of it. It's really, it was really quite extraordinary that, and you may recall, okay, I keep saying I'll shut up and then I don't quite do it. The village of Chenega Bay, in the Good Friday earthquake in 1964, was destroyed, and a quarter of the population was killed in that event. The community have abandoned the original village location because of a variety of reasons, but certainly they felt really vulnerable, and there were very bad feelings associated with what had happened there. They had spent 25 years gathering resources to rebuild the community, which they did. And they had just reestablished it. People had moved back in. It was a very positive feeling in that place. And on Good Friday, 1989, the Exxon Valdez ran aground and dumped 11 million gallons of crude oil on the village. It was crucial that there be baseline information, but also that the relationships be there to be able to talk to people about what was happening and what could be done to help. So I say that vignette just because it's a kind of confirmatory thing about how unexpected things are and how dynamic communities have to be in order to survive. And the community survived. And some of what was done with the work that Division of Subsistence had already prepared was crucial in helping them survive.
And I would assume that you're also thinking about the personnel that had been trained in those years with the division.
Yes. Yes. And also the relationships that, frankly, and thank you for reminding me, Bill, the part of the relationships here were not just relationships in the villages or in the region, but also with other staff in, say, the Habitat Division of Alaska Department of Fish and Game, the Fisheries Division, Commercial Comfish, because many of the affected communities were commercial fishermen. So those relationships also mattered, and I think that's germane to your point.
I would just add that when the people of Chenega were reestablishing their community in the early 1980s, they actually came to us and asked, well, or they said, we want to reestablish our subsistence hunting and fishing traditions. How do we go about that? And what obstacles might there be? And we work with them to actually change the subsistence fishing regulations in Prince William Sound to be consistent with how they wanted to fish and how they needed to fish. But you're absolutely right regarding the relationships, because when EVOs happened, we had experienced people who had been in literally every community that was in the path of the oil, from Cordova into Tiklik, all the way out to Ivanhoe Bay.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Well said, Jim. And I remember back to, was it Lee who did so much of the work there?
Yes, Lee Stratton.
That was good work, and it was baseline work. So I think you can say if you agree. I think it provided a real basis. And would we have predicted that, the uses that it would get? Well, of course not. Otherwise, we would have designed history differently starting in March of 1989. But it was the quality of the work was immediately apparent because we could build on it.
Well, that kind of leads to a question I have about how the division decided which communities to go do work in. And was it, oh, there's an issue coming up with the board, we better go do this? Or, why did you already have all that information for Prince William Sound?
Let me give a part of the what I think is the answer. To some degree, the areas of emphasis for the division's work, when I joined the section and then the division, were already in motion, and we had people building relationships and gathering data, like Lee Stratton and others. That was already happening, so to some degree, it was grandfathered in, but. The part of the reason that it was good to have it grandfathered in is because these were areas that had very active policy needs, management needs, where I'm going to say not much work had been done prior to the subsistence division's work on really getting baseline information about how those communities used. Renewable wild resources. I'm not going to say that there wasn't anything done. I don't mean that, but that's where Lee Stratton and Ron Stanek and others really stepped in and saw the need because we knew that there were going to be issues arising if they hadn't already. We talked about Tyonek, which is not in Prince William Sound, but in Cook Inlet, where we could see. Things that were on the horizon, no matter what. And a reasonable person would be prepared to ask us, well, what do you know about these communities and how they depend on fish and wildlife and or intertidal organisms or whatever it is. And then if we weren't prepared to give a meaningful answer, we were not paying attention. And so that's, I think, the way we developed it. But frankly, Karen, the other part is where did we have resources? Where did we have enough staffing and enough budget that we could do a meaningful job? And that always is a factor. You can't do everything all at once. And so we wanted to pay attention to those issues where our contribution would be most meaningful. Usually, but not always, that would involve the boards of fisheries and game. Sometimes it would be habitat, sometimes it would be other parts of the overall management issue. Could involve land exchanges and just a number of different things. But we could see that things were underway or would soon be underway that a reasonable person would ask us. For input, or that we hoped they would ask us for input because it was important that be represented. But it was also a pragmatic decision. What's likely to come up early? Do we have the resources to make a real contribution? If we do, who's going to do it? And then what's the format going to be? Are we going to use mapped data? Are we going to be doing something else about the seasonal round of activities? Anyway, that's what my answer would be. It really is a mixture of different factors, and then our budget would vary depending on what the legislature had to work with and how much of whether there was a drop in revenues or whatever, in the same way that any state agency would have that happen. I'm curious whether Jim would have a perspective. Though different from mine in
Well,
terms of how we chose to set the targets.
it's not different, but it follows up on that because we're talking about relationships with communities, relationships with Alaska Native groups. The other area where the division very actively developed relationships with was federal agencies.
Yes.
And I think you know, Denny, that this is maybe true as much now as it used to be within the department overall, but we didn't necessarily. The department didn't necessarily look on federal agencies with a great deal of fondness. But for the first 10 or 12 years of the program, the division was helping the state be in compliance with federal law. There wasn't a federal subsistence board. And for the most part, federal agencies came to us
Yeah.
and offered us funding to do research, sometimes in partnership with them, almost always in partnership with a regional Native organization. So another area where decisions are made about what communities to work in had to do with what communities were associated with federal lands, what communities federal agencies were interested in. And so that became a source of funding and a source of support. You maybe have something to say about relationships with federal
No,
agencies.
I, Jim, that's you're you spoke to it very clearly and well. I think that was a way of leveraging our resources, but also leveraging their resources, and it was really quite efficient. The other thing is some of the federal agency staff really valued what we did, and that was helpful. It was really helpful. Sometimes as well, they had issues that were going to be really important on both state and federal lands or waters. And the fact that they were going to deal with them made it important that we, as a technical research agency, I don't know what to properly call to the subsistence division because it's a mixture of disciplines, but often that ability to leverage resources, particularly where the effect of a policy decision or regulatory decision would extend not just to the boundary of federal lands, but would affect communities that use both federal and non-federal lands, that was a real opportunity and a real and really quite important. Plus, we could have relationships that maybe there were kind of political obstacles too. And Karen, I'm thinking, for example, at least one and maybe more than one of the people that are in your jukebox inventory of sources were people that were really good colleagues for us, although they were federal agency staff. And there were some federal agency staff that really made very personal commitments to the issues that were important in our work, and sometimes took real personal risks. And I'm thinking of one whose name I won't mention, whose steering cables were cut on the airplane that he was about to take off in Arctic, Alaska, taking off from state lands and flying over federal lands. This was not, this was hardball. And it was really important that people who were responsible, thoughtful about policy, but also about how all of this affects the residents of those regions, how we work together. Anyway, now I'm off onto a tangent, but one that I have never been able to let go of because those are people who would build close relationships with us because they perceived that we were truthful and we were committed to not only the communities, but also to the resources on which those communities depended during their complex round of seasonal use and also the economic values that they represented. So there, see, I insisted on not adding much, and I went on way too long.
No, this is good. Your observations and thoughts are good.
We've been running about 2 hours. Do we want to think about wrapping this up? And there has been some talk, Denny, about trying to get together a panel with interaction between speakers. And Jim and Karen may want to say something about that or not.
Yeah, the idea would be once we interview a number of people that cover some of the same topics, we might ask them to review the interviews and then get them together as a group to talk about some topics that maybe we didn't explore or that had different perspectives on, and maybe even involve a few Division of Subsistence people, contemporary. To ask some questions. We haven't committed to doing this yet, but it'd probably be you and Steve, Larry, maybe Norm. If we track down Elizabeth Andrews, maybe Maybe Elizabeth would be part of that. So it's just something to think about that we might want to do. I had, but
I can give you a quick answer from me, which is I think that would be very productive, and happy to participate if you decide that that's a valuable thing to do.
yeah, and that was indeed Jim Magdance's original vision, was to have panels. And because of budgets and other things, we haven't gone that route, but it might be that we can have a little bit of compromise or various methods. But if we don't want to wrap it up right now, I had two things that we don't have to talk about too much about, and one of them is a question. I sometimes feel that the division's contributions, programs, legacy is not well acknowledged publicly or in certain contexts. And an early example was in the mid-80s during the Berger hearings, looking more at ANCSA and the issue of the sale of stock and so forth. And there is, talk about subsistence there, but the state winds up sort of being, wearing a black hat, and being the bad guy. And if somebody like me would actually be there and say something about our program, people would acknowledge it. But it was as if it wasn't as acknowledged as maybe it could be. Do you have any? Did you have observations like that? And
I think you are correct. In fact, I thought that some of the, I won't be able to cite a specific example, but I remember, valuable as the Berger Commission was, there some of it I thought was sort of a too simplistic, and some of it was kind of the stereotype of this what the state bureaucrat would be. And that's not what the Division of Subsistence Staffing was about. It was far more nuanced and responsive than that. The Berger Commission had a complex and high intensity short-term kind of task. So maybe it shouldn't be a surprise that some of that crept in, but I think you're right. I think it's kind of it is unfortunate, partly because the subsistence division was inventing itself, and inventing itself in a way that I think has proven quite responsible, but also quite thoughtful, and even scholarly, but the scholarly work that you could put legs on. And so I think you're right. I don't need to embellish it. I think you're exactly right. It's been less than fully appreciated, and maybe even not fully, the stories have not been fully told. So I can stop there. I'm happy to say more, but it's not necessary. You said it clearly.
And I think, now a lot of the conversation is about co-management and the role of Alaska Native communities more directly in activities, and all those are, those are worthy topics and might be the direction things go in. But I also think, hindsight is 2020, and
Right.
when our program was being developed in the late 70s and early 80s, that kind of discussion was just not going to happen. It was hard enough to get acknowledgement that the kind of work that we did was even relevant. And the other point that you made early, that I think was really worth repeating, is that we, as a program, had multiple constituencies that we had to satisfy. There was the local communities, the Alaska Native community, but also the boards and our colleagues within the department. So there is a balancing act there. And the ultimate thing was integrity of the program and the reliability availability of the information and what we knew to be a not a neutral stance, but a scientific stance on the information. We were accused of being advocates, and in our hearts, maybe we were, but that's not how we approached our work. The other thing.
It's really well said. We, of course, we had a viewpoint. That's part of how analysis works. We had a viewpoint. That's different than taking a partisan position or skewing the data or going into it with the idea that we had to generate a particular outcome and we would make it fit what we had to say. I don't think we ever did that.
I don't think so either.
And we
No.
made sure we didn't do that because our credibility and our integrity were intrinsically linked.
Yeah. The other thing that I wanted to ask you a little bit about, and this hasn't come up before, but one of the people that was really instrumental in developing our program early was Linda Ilana. And she's not with us anymore to give her perspective on that. And you mentioned a little bit that when you started, she must have started about the same time. And so you went the policy route and she went the research route. Could you talk a little bit about her contribution?
I hugely value her contribution, and we lost her way too early. So Jim, here's how I kind of saw it. I will inadvertently leave someone out, so I'm really, please correct me, but I saw kind of an intellectual threesome driving the quality of our research. The department is not used to real research, although there were biologists and ecologists who did real research. I don't mean, I'm not trying to be, that's not a pejorative, but they're used to management studies. You and Bob Wolf and Linda Ilana brought this genuine intellectual depth that I thought was extremely valuable. And then others had depth as well on the staff, but it was a different mix. But that power of coming in with a sense of what good science is, and I mean not just biological science, social science, human geography, a variety of other tools, was crucial in shaping the future. And Linda Ilana, we lost her early, but look at what an important effect she had, including hiring the right people. So Jim Fall, Bob Wolf, that's not by accident that
Elizabeth Andrews.
and oh yes, how could I possibly leave Elizabeth Andrews out, especially given her leadership role later? But she was somebody I really relied on, partly because of her energy, but partly because of her intellectual capacity. And it, yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you flagged that. I think one of the real strengths, and it was really hard for the boards of fisheries and game to embrace, was how what you did, what the division did, was valuable as a set of data and analysis that had applicability for management, but also that furthered the field, that furthered the disciplines, the academic and analytical insights. And that's, those are not equally valued, especially in a management agency like the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Linda Ilana never lost track of that. And she had strong ties in Northwest Alaska, especially the King Island community, which at that point was the King Island community in Nome. But she had great passion for telling the stories, getting the information right, being not afraid to get into the field and test the ideas or test the assumptions, the null hypothesis, whatever, the right language is. And I can just picture her, because her energy sometimes, she would just practically be popping out of her chair, with either enthusiasm for the task or objection to the bias. And it never failed. She never sacrificed that, never backed off of it. What she brought, along with you and Elizabeth and Bob, was the passion for the science. And I'm going to, I mean ethnography, ethnology, geography. She may have been trained as an anthropologist, but she was a human geographer at heart. She never let go of that. And the part that I could bring was the way that that connects with how policy actually works, and how what's worth going to the mat for, and what is just window dressing. I know there's more than one metaphor there, but that's all right with me.
Another thing that Linda did was she maintained connections to the academic community. And what I
Yes.
remember in the early years that I worked for the division is she would bring in, especially Canadians, but also Alaskans, academics who
Yep.
contribute to the quality of our program. We had workshops and training sessions pretty frequently, actually, in the early years, because we were developing the program. And Linda
Yeah.
pulled that off. And then, of course, she went into an academic position mid-80s.
Yeah, yeah, thank you. That's exactly right. And some of them I can name. Some of the academics that were really important. Let's face it, Bill Schneider is one of them, but really important academic research, academic leadership. Tiger Bush, Peter Usher, whom I'm leaving out a ton of people, but that is exactly. That was empowering, really empowering, and she never let go of that. And thank goodness. Plus, I thought those were really great workshops or training sessions, and I got to participate in them, and I found them to be very, very, very valuable. But also, it set us up as kind of unassailable. That is to say, we weren't just pushing an outcome. We were trying to get things done that contributed to our overall understanding of how these systems work. Anyway, you would have said that better than I, but it was a really powerful thing. And she was a driver. She just had the right energy. She was a great character, and that connection to scholarly work was crucial for our identity as a as an outfit.
And just a as an aside, my first day sort of on the job, although I wasn't really hired yet, was there was a staff meeting at the top floor of the Hilton in downtown Anchorage. This is September of 1981, and I met most of the division staff then, but it was a training session, and Ray Bain was there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure.
Dick Nelson was there, and Bob Wolf was there. He wasn't actually hired yet. And they went through various methods. In fact, I was also invited to do something during that session. So, I mean, that got me off on the right track, with it. Here are these people that really know what they're doing, and we're interested in learning from them, and they're interested in what we're doing. So it
Yeah.
that
Well,
was
that's great. Yeah. And when you mention Ray Bain, for example, that is also a person with whom our team had a cross government agency relationship.
The Park Service,
And I'm not, he's not the only one. Ted Swem and others. And of
Bob
course,
Bellis. Bob Bellis, sorry.
Bob Bellis. Yes. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, well
I
said.
just have a couple of quick questions. going back to something you mentioned earlier, which is about the staff and what a great staff the whole division was. And I'm just wondering how those field researchers, how did you decide who to hire? What were the qualifications you were looking for?
Karen, partly I'm going to have to give a multi-part answer, but I promise not to be long. We can talk about it more, and especially if we get together as a panel. I was looking for a mixture of skill sets, and if there were pre-existing relationships in regions that had a subsistence uses as a major part of the socioeconomic life of the region, that was even better, maybe even more important. And so I would be looking for that. But the other thing is, what happened really was people like, there were some people on board already, like, I mean, Linda Alana and Tom Lahner deserve a lot of credit for getting things really rolling in that direction. So when I stepped in, we already had some pretty sound people. Jim Fall came quickly thereafter. Bob Wolf.
You hired Jim Magnance, right?
I did. Yes, and Susan Georgette, and who else was? I can't quite say her name, although I almost did earlier today. Susan Georgette was already on staff, but will you forgive me if I tell the Magdan story?
Go ahead,
please.
I grew up in small town Iowa, and I would go back at different holidays. And I went back for at Christmas time to Iowa to visit my family, my parents, and I've. The only place to fly into was Des Moines, and the only place to fly out of to go to Seattle and then on to Fairbanks was Des Moines. And as I was boarding in Des Moines to go back up to Fairbanks to Dog Patch where I lived, a guy was in the line with me, behind me in the line, and he had a boarding pass. Remember when they had paper boarding passes, envelopes? And in purple magic marker, it said Shungnak. And I thought, oh gosh, this has got to be a story. It's got to be something. So I flew to Seattle and then changed planes. And by pure dumb luck, I'm sitting in the same row as this guy with the purple Shungnak.
Wow.
Well, it was Jim Magdance. And he had a grant, the Alicia Patterson Foundation grant. To go to Shungnak because he had been the photojournalist assigned to go with a group of elementary school kids. I think the whole class of elementary school kids from Shungnak brought to a dairy farm in Iowa by the daughter of the people whose dairy farm it was. She'd grown up on the farm and who was a teacher in Shungnak. And she had gotten a grant from somewhere else to bring him to Iowa to see what it, for a cultural experience. So they went to the dairy farm and they saw other things. And Jim was the Des Moines Register photojournalist assigned to tag along with them. And he noticed that there was something special, something different about how those kids thought about their world and how they perceived this weird place, this, Iowa, weird place. So he got this grant and he was on his way to Shungnak. So I said, well, why don't you just stay at my house tonight and you can catch the flight to Shungnak tomorrow. But we spent the whole flight from Seattle just talking about rural Alaska and what he hoped to do. And he did, in fact, spend the year in Shungnak and has a fabulous book that you probably both have, all three of you have seen called The Village.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, it's powerful. And powerful in lots of ways, including his having done exactly what the Division of Subsistence would have asked him to do, which is to go back to the village and say, "Have I told the truth here? Have I represented it correctly?" And there was a terrible event that happened while he was there, involving the crash of a small plane with passengers on board that resulted in several deaths and a very close call, and one child who had been, was thrown out of the airplane and covered up in a snowdrift and was not found right away, but who survived. Including going back to those people who had lost relatives in this crash. And Jim had the pictures of the crash and of the just, you know, this terrible event. And he wanted to know if that was okay to tell that story. And now I can barely tell it. And the people who lost family said, "This is really helpful to us. This is really good because someone understands what we experienced." And I thought, this was, you know, this was before he went. But I thought, here's a guy that can understand how to tell a story and can do something good. And then after he finished his year, we had a conversation, and I thought, there's this piece in the skill set that we don't have. Maybe this is something that can help us tell a story in a different way. So that's how I hired Jim. And it all started with the purple shungnak.
My other last question is, we're talking about the Tayonek case, which was sort of before you, but while you were the regional supervisor and the director, what were some of the big subsistence issues happening in that time that you got involved with, and how did those get resolved?
Well, Tayonek was still boiling because of the litigation. And Jim, do you remember whether was that in Ron Stanek's bailiwick at that point, or was Alice still working that territory? I think Alice was in the YK Delta by then.
I think that's right. Well, Alice did the interviews in Tayonek in early 1980, but then I think she wound up in Bethel or wherever. And Ron had come in by that point. We asked Ron about that, and he said he was not at that meeting, did not play an initial role. But then he, of course, was there when the fishery was being monitored, so he started in at that point.
But I was wondering, what other big issues,
I'm sorry,
like
Karen.
not she
I didn't
no
mean to miss. Well, not necessarily in chronological order. There were some obvious ones like Neltina Caribou. That one was a tough issue, actually, and a
still is.
difficult story for us to tell accurately. Not that we couldn't, but it's complex. The Western Arctic caribou herd was a really difficult one, and the porcupine caribou herd as well, because of the kind of the I'll call them oscillations, but that makes the population changes in those herds sound more regular than they really are. And then there were smaller issues that were nevertheless quite profound. For example, the litigation that involved whether taking a moose out of season for a funeral potlatch would be protected under Alaska's law, not as necessarily a subsistence use, but under basically the constitutional guarantees of religious freedom, and as well as the management of resources. That went to the US, the Alaska Supreme Court while I was there. And frankly, because of the work that our team had done, not as advocates there, but really helping to understand why that really mattered in a in this case, Athabascan community, Minto. Why that mattered? Because, and I'm sorry, this is a longer piece of this than you needed, Karen, but the reason that was so important is it's difficult for some people, elders especially if English was not their most comfortable language, to explain why it matters. And so a star witness in that litigation was trying to describe why having a moose at a funeral potlatch was so important. And he said, well, because we wouldn't feel good about it. We wouldn't like it. And so our expertise, and they weren't called as witnesses, but it helped to make clear what that meant. It wasn't having to do with pleasure, it had to do with meaning for that community. And the Alaska Supreme Court agreed, actually, and protected that use. So is that a big issue? No, but it is an issue that has to do with the fundamental fabric of how traditional communities develop their set of relationships with the resources around them. So that was one. Oh gosh, the fisheries were already having a lot of trouble in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. A lot of stuff having to do with fishing, but also hunting in the YK Delta communities and Nelson Island. All of that was kind of in play. The Northwest Arctic had some hot issues, and of course, the Western Arctic caribou herd is one of them. But there were a lot of issues having to do with hunting, brown bear hunting, for example, that were crucial. I think Susan Georgette's work that was really significant. I mean, I asked the three of you, but I was thinking, Bill and Jim, am I missing some major ones that I should have thought of already?
Don't know.
Karen, you may know as well, but
Well, the Nelchina one, talking about how complicated that was, maybe, and how you guys navigated that. I don't know if Copper River salmon was an issue.
Yeah, that's another one. Yeah.
It is, yeah, thanks. It is another issue. And yes. And Copper River salmon is both a challenging issue from a subsistence and a management issue, but also it's a kind of a, it involves a, I don't mean this as a pejorative, but it involves a kind of a commercial value that's created by commercial fishing interests that is really valuable in the region, because Copper River salmon is seen as kind of the highest level of value, of the highest level of seafood quality. And a lot of that is because that's the way it was created. I mean, the perception, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's not a, I'm not claiming that that's somehow illegitimate. But these things were all operating together in the Copper River situation and the reliance of fish, commercial fishing communities. It is they're intertwined. It's so textured. Or maybe I should, maybe the metaphor should be, it's more like a weaving than a than the metaphor that I was using. But yeah, I and those I, on the one hand, those are tough issues. On the other, they're interesting issues, and they're worth really investing to try to understand, and also investing because they matter so much to the different participants in those different uses.
Yeah, they're certainly complicated, and how you guys navigated that is a little bit mind-boggling.
How'd you do that, Jim?
I don't know. Well, a lot of with a lot of help. I guess the way the answer is with a lot of help. Yeah, but it's probably not something we want to get into now after 2.5 hours. But it was, we handled it like we handled so many other things. We talked to a lot of people. We partnered with the various participants in the fishery, including the Fairbanks dip netters. We partnered with them, and they helped us link to individuals who had dip netted in the Copper River as for most of their lives, and who weren't native people. And it's often, Denny, you sort of implied this earlier. We sometimes were criticized for focusing on Alaska Native communities and not working very much with non-native places. I don't think that's correct. I think there are a lot of examples where the subsistence program sought out the views, the experiences of non-native people, and that's one example of it.
That's good. That's a good example.
Yeah.
And that also, I won't take the tangent now, but that also played out during the Exxon Valdez oil spill aftermath,
Yeah.
is those relationships that were significant throughout were not just with native villages. They were also very important with non-native uses and community reliance on commercial fishing.
Yeah.
We Bill, Jim, anything else? Or
Well, I'm looking over my long list here, and I think we've touched on most of it. Maybe not all of it, but
I'm sure
probably
there's
enough.
more.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's
Oh.
more we need to do, but I think this is a good time to close now, and we can follow up.
Let's
Denny,
Den
thank you.
Well, I want to say you should feel free to edit out anything since you couldn't seem to shut me up today. This
No,
is
that's
good.
no, no. That's the whole point of this, is you're on the stage. You get to say everything you need to say.
Well, I printed out everything that you sent me, Karen, and I used it. And then I printed out, oh, this is yellow paper because I was out of other paper. This is my Jim Fall note, which
Oh,
is
right.
highlighted again in yellow to make
Right.
sure I
Me
didn't miss
too.
any of the key questions. So
I have Jim's list as well. All right. Well, we really appreciate your time, Denny.
thank you for this opportunity to talk with you. One of the beauties of it is that I value so much that experience with the Division of Subsistence, and value what the staff really, I mean, the team brought such great depth and sensitivity to their work. There's not a day that goes by that I don't rely on some aspect of that, and I so value it, but I don't get to talk about it very much. So this has been good for me.
Good.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we'll be able to follow up with some group discussion at some point. Yeah.
Good. I'll stand by.
Yeah.